You're listening to Valley Public Radio. This weekend, the second longest continually running keyboard concert series in the nation starts its 43rd season at Fresno State, the Philip Lorenz Memorial Keyboard Concert Series. It's second only to Carnegie Hall, according to the organizers of the event. It begins with a familiar name to Fresno audiences, pianist Garrick Olson, who performs Sunday at 3 o'clock, and he joins us now on the phone from San Francisco. Mr. Olson, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you very much.
He'll be performing works by Beethoven, Chopin, and Scriabin in this concert, which kicks off the season of the series. Garrick, I want to start out by talking a little about your career. You're a familiar name to Central California listeners. This is, as I understand it, your sixth performance as part of the concert series?
Oh, at least. I'm going to guess it might even be more.
So I imagine you've had a chance to get to know some of the people here, Andreas Wertz and others. It has to be great to come back to a place where you meet old friends.
Oh, it always is, and it's a great pleasure. But the greatest pleasure, of course, Andreas is, like Philip before him, is doing a wonderful job with the series. But what I like the best about it is the intensity and seriousness of the audience, which hears a lot of great keyboard concerts in this series, and it's a very intense and knowledgeable and hungry public. I mean, it's marvelous, and that is perhaps the most gratifying thing.
Yes, and this year's season is very interesting as it features not only Garrick Olson, but then in October, Richard Good, Barry Douglas, and many others returning to Fresno this year. Your concert that is coming up on Sunday is one that features some wonderful pieces. I want to talk about the Beethoven Sonata in a little bit, but I want to, for a moment, before we do that, talk about your career and your work going all the way back to 1970 when you became the first and only American to earn the gold medal in the International Chopin Competition in Warsaw. What was that like, and what do you think about that now, so many years later? How did that change you as an artist?
Well, it did many, many, many things. Principally, it launched my career on an international level. Piano competitions exist to really uncover and call attention to significant new talents. Part of the problem with them is that they've become so popular now that there are almost too many everywhere, so it's hard to keep track of who wins what. But certainly the Chopin competition, almost uniquely, has been one of the very biggest ones and the one whose track record of winners has been extremely significant. There are many winners of the Moscow, Tchaikovsky, Queen Elizabeth of Belgium, or Van Cliburn, or other competitions, who haven't actually sustained visible careers too successfully, but most of the winners of the Chopin have gone on to major international recognition. Having said that, how did it change me? Well, speaking of an informed and educated and intense public, of course, Chopin is virtually a secular saint in Poland for a number of reasons, including the greatness of his music, of course, and being considered the greatest and most internationally popular Polish composer, but also the fact that he lived at a time when Poland was not on the map, and he became the symbol of the aspirations of a nation, and to a degree that perhaps he might not have even liked to recognize by the time the 20th century rolled around, but we'll never know. So he is a symbol of who they are. I mean, Poland is not a small country, but it's not huge like Germany or France or England, and any country that's not, you know, one of the hugest players in the world gets recognized by the rest of the world for a few of its people. And as one Pole once joked with me, he said, well, before John Paul II, he said, I mean, if you said who's a Pole, they would say Copernicus or Chopin. Now he said, now we've got three. So in any case, but it was, the intensity is palpable. It at the time it was, and maybe still, it's one of the largest events going on in the country. Of course, it was a time of communism and relatively little public media and not entire freedom of those of the public media, and yet it was as big as, I mean, I won't say it's the World Cup, but I mean it's as big as a major sporting event, and people really follow it, and we saw our pictures and our names on the front pages of the paper and you know, radio and TV broadcasts. So it's a very huge thing. So that was incredibly thrilling, but it did the trick for me. I mean, it launched me, it got me my first dates in all of the world's major music capitals, and that is really the practical function. And so I'm eternally grateful for it. Plus, it brought me a terrific relationship with Poland and during a turbulent time in her history. And, you know, it just cemented my already pretty deep relationship with Chopin.
Let's talk about that relationship with Chopin. You've been called one of the world's leading practitioners of his music. What is it about Chopin's music that drew you to it, to really invest so much time and artistry into his music? Obviously a great genius, but was there something in particular about Chopin that spoke to you in a way that maybe other composers didn't? Or and what have you continually been able to find there for so many years in playing his
work? Well, of course. I mean, yes. No, it's not that other composers don't speak to those things, too. They do. But the particular personality and manner that Chopin addressed things. First of all, I think I fell in love with Chopin a little bit later in life. I was already a mid-teenager when I did. Before that, I liked Liszt better. He was sort of more of a young boy's composer.
A little flashy.
Noisy and large-scaled and aggressive and brilliant and a real somebody who could wow the crowd. Chopin was much more intimate, and it took me a little while to catch him. But when I did, I got more and more enthusiastic. Now, of course, what I loved about Chopin is probably what everybody loves about Chopin, is just the sheer beauty of the music and the beauty of the tunes and the deep emotional content that really touches the heart so much. But, of course, when you're a teenager, you don't think of all those things. You just think that you like it, and you love it. And as I grew to know it better, I got more and more intrigued. You see, at first I thought Chopin was just this ever so gorgeous composer who wrote sort of the dessert on piano recitals, you know, the beautiful suite that everybody was waiting to hear. And then as I began to get to know him more in depth, I discovered not only is there a great deal more, he's not even particularly the dessert composer. It's just that his music has such an allure tonally on the surface and such a melodic genius that people always really kind of flip out over him. But I discovered a powerful creator, perhaps I would say on the level of Bach, Mozart, or Beethoven, I mean, which is not always where everybody puts him, but these days more people do, as one of the, you know, most profound geniuses, psychologically, emotionally, musically. I mean, a great master of form and innovator, but just the sheer profundity and even and occasionally perfection of the music. And by perfection, I don't mean just superficial perfection, but deeply perfect the way a lot of Mozart is. I mean, it's just nothing can really be altered without ruining it. But you know, I mean, you couldn't change a note or, in some cases, a dynamic or a phrase. So he's retained his fascination for me all these years.
If you just joined us today on Valley Public Radio, our guest is Garrick Olson. He's performing in the first concert of this year's season of the Philip Lorenz Memorial Keyboard Concert Series at Fresno State's Concert Hall Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. He's performing works by Beethoven, by Schubert, and Scriabin. I want to talk about the Beethoven Sonata Opus 109 that you'll be performing. This is one of Beethoven's last sonatas, as I understand it. Tell me about your thoughts on this piece.
First, I have to just be amused at my younger self. I learned this piece when I was 15. Don't ask me why. I just loved it. I mean, it's a late Beethoven piece. It's considered very complex and very, very difficult. But when I was 15, I was very adventurous. Anyway, so it's been in my bones for a long time, and I've studied it with a couple of teachers along the way. I mean, a long time ago. With two of my most important teachers, so I have had their viewpoints on it, and of course I've heard just about every great pianist of our time play it, and I've heard, you know, and I've played it dozens and dozens of times myself. What's unique about this to me is the fact, we could talk for hours about this piece, but it's one. The third movement is really the meat of the issue. It's by far the longest movement. The first two almost serve as introductions. It's a beautiful aria and variations in Beethoven's sort of transcendent mode, which he goes even a step further in the famous 111, and a beautiful aria which Beethoven then dissects various elements of harmony, rhythm, and, I mean, he sort of takes everything apart, and he shows you every possible aspect. It's a transformational set of variations, the way the Goldbergs are of Bach. In other words, when you hear the aria at the end of the Goldbergs, it doesn't sound like it did at the beginning because of everything that's happened to it in the meantime. And the same thing happens in this piece. The aria is sung gently at the very end. But after all the transformations and all the realizations of what it is, of its potential, you hear it in an entirely different light. And before that, there's a transcendent variation in which Beethoven becomes very obsessed with trills. And, you know, it's a bit like, angel's wings taking off or something. But it's just, you know, about vibration. And with late Beethoven, you get very much into cosmic language. Because his music suggests it, so it's not necessarily one of the great ascensions into heaven, but it's where Beethoven is pushing the boundaries of heaven, and yet comes gently back to earth, and you feel totally, transcendently transformed by this experience.
That's a great way of putting it, though. Describing Beethoven's late work. Speaking of hearing things in a different light, you mentioned that you started playing that piece when you were 15. Do you ever go back and think about how you performed a particular piece at different stages in your career and then think about where you are now as an artist and how has that changed?
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no, because mostly the changes are organic. In other words, I, of course, have tapes and recordings of me and even a commercial recording of me doing this now 25 years ago. I don't actually make any reference to them. I can't say I'm not interested, but I don't want to go hear my younger self because I'm just much more interested in where I am right now with it. And I have no idea how I played it when I was 15. I probably pretty decently for a 15-year-old kid, but I don't think it was a fully realized performance. But it was probably pretty. I was talented, and it was probably pretty good. But no, I don't really think back too much. I do think to the wonderful two teachers, Rosina Levine and Olga Barabini, with whom I worked this piece in great, great detail. But I also think of the great musicians I've heard and all the thoughts I've had about it. It's such a great work that this is a work that no interpreter can encompass in any one performance. In other words, there's more in here than can be revealed at once. So sorry if I'm disappointing, but no, I don't actually think about my former self too much.
It's fascinating. You're also performing a number of pieces by Scriabin. Tell me about those.
Wow. Scriabin, he's a special passion of mine. Scriabin shares a couple of odd things with Beethoven. Now, first of all, we have to remember that Scriabin was a megalomaniac and did not like Beethoven. And he didn't like Brahms, and he didn't like lots of other things. He loved Chopin when he was young. Now, of course, Beethoven never knew Chopin. But the odd things that Scriabin shares with Beethoven are that his work is very easily divided into an early, middle, and late period. I mean, any composer or writer can have that, or painter can have that done. But it's somehow the dividing lines, there seem to be three sort of distinct styles. In the first period, he's writing in a very Chopin-esque language, in Chopin-esque style. He was obsessed with Chopin and Chopin's genius musically and for the piano. In Beethoven's early days, he writes in the received language of Haydn and Mozart. Not that he wasn't terribly original, but in the same way that, you know, Faulkner writes in the language of Shakespeare. It's all English, but they say different things. And they both wrote in a received language, but they were very individual. In their second period, they become more heroic and much more expansive and outward bound and are challenging the world. They're challenging the limitations of form and expanding things and going kind of wild in a certain way. And in their third period, the late period in both cases, they're getting more inward, more abstruse, more concentrated, more difficult to follow, much more complex and much less direct, and even in both cases more mystical. Scriabin was an outright mystic and theosophist. Beethoven was not, but Beethoven was very mystically influenced, and Beethoven's late period was at a time when ideas from Eastern philosophy, religion, and thought were beginning to penetrate to Europe, and he was very intrigued with it all. There was a time when we didn't know what karma was and all those things, or Zen, or what, you know, or whatever you have. So Scriabin is puzzling because he wrote mostly music for piano, with the exception of some orchestral music, and he wrote hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And they're pianistically works of genius, but when you see the name Scriabin on the program, you don't even know what kind of sound you're going to hear, because if you have an early piece of Scriabin, it could almost be by Chopin. If you have a late piece by Scriabin, it could almost be by Schoenberg or Stravinsky.
It's quite a range.
Yeah, his tonal language morphed very organically throughout his life. And so although he never arrived at an absolute atonality, he was one of the many composers in the beginning of the 20th century pushing the tonal language to what eventually became its breakup around the time of World War I. In other words, he was right up there at the barricades with Schoenberg, Stravinsky, Debussy, Busoni, whoever you have, all the very most advanced creators. And and his late music is often very puzzling harmonically and hard to grasp. And often his, like Beethoven, his thematic writing becomes very more what people call telegraph style. He says, for example, the opening theme group of 109 by Beethoven is 8 bars long, and it's gone before you've heard it. And yet he tells you all the information in there, just like telegraph style. In other words, everything unessential is left out. Scriabin starts doing a similar sort of thing. And like Beethoven, he becomes very preoccupied with trills. Who knows whether that's an expression of the Holy Spirit or cosmic radiance or what, but in any case, certainly the trills are very, very present and used a lot for expressive and almost impressionistic tonal devices. So I don't want to go too much about the parallels between them because the differences are much greater. But Scriabin really, really fascinates me. And on this program, I have a little bit of music from all three periods, so you get quite a taster. And the one work I'd like to single out is the Fifth Sonata, which I believe might be his greatest masterpiece. It's one of the most hair-raisingly exciting things to listen to and play. I would say there's probably no single work in the piano literature that I find excites me more when I play it. I mean, it's really hard to hold on for the ride because you get so carried away. In it, he quotes his own prose poem, The Poem of Ecstasy. And it's really, I mean, he's a very extreme character. What does he say? I call you to life, O mysterious forces buried in the depths of the creative spirit. Timid shadows of life, to you I bring audacity. So he's not very middle class. He really pushes the boundaries real hard. I think he was looking toward the salvation of mankind and thought he was part of it. When he died prematurely of an infection, which now could be cured, he was working on his Mysterium, which was to be performed on the banks. No, not on the banks, at the foothills of the Himalayas, with no difference between the public and the performers, with thousands of people performing, mixing ritual, sound, light, smell, and music and all sorts of things. The beginning would be, the people would be summoned to this performance by bells hanging from clouds. So he was pretty psychotropic in his attitude.
Well, it's certainly going to be an interesting concert for listeners coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, featuring pianist Garrick Olson, kicking off the 43rd season of the Philip Lorenz Memorial Keyboard Concert Series at Fresno State, performing works by Beethoven, Schubert, and Scriabin. Garrick Olson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.